This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, and it's great to be back with you here on President's Day. We begin today's show with a look at the realities for asylum seekers trying to come to the United States but being held just across the border in Mexico. Earlier this year, a group of roughly 1,700 Central American migrants traveled toward the United States with the goal of requesting asylum at the Eagle Pass port of entry. Instead, the asylum seekers were detained by Mexican security forces before they even reached the U.S. border. Local authorities have since held the migrants in an abandoned factory in the Mexican town of Piedras Negras, Coahuila, and media outlets have not been allowed inside the facility, but journalists have been able to interview migrants through a fence.
I hope we can all go through to the U.S. because it's for a future for our children. What we want is a future for our kids, like everyone else in the world, because in our country, we can't guarantee that.
Last week, migrants attempted to escape the facility, but Mexican security forces and riot police blocked their exit. Some migrants with Mexican humanitarian visas have been allowed to leave the property, but they were placed on buses to parts unknown, preventing them from seeking asylum at the Eagle Pass port of entry.
No.
We don't want to return to our country. The truth is that the situation in Honduras is very, very ugly. It's really bad with the violence, as well as basic resources, and there is also no work.
On Saturday, Mexican officials announced plans to close the Piedras Negras compound this week, with plans to bus the remaining migrants to neighboring cities. Meanwhile, President Trump is moving forward with his declaration of a national emergency in order to divert money to build the border wall. And according to immigration advocates, it's a change in policy under the Trump administration that has created a bottleneck for migrants in border towns like Piedras Negras. Advocates have noted that the U.S. government is currently processing just 15 asylum claims per day at the port of entry. For more on the conditions for asylum seekers on the Mexican side of the border, we now turn to Alice Driver. She's a freelance journalist based in Mexico who's been reporting from Piedras Negras, and she also collected the audio we just heard. Alice, thanks for joining us again on The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
So let's talk about this current group of migrants who are being held in this facility. Where are they from, and who are they? Are we talking families?
So the group left from Honduras. It was around 2,000 people, they say, when it left. And by the time they arrived in Piedras Negras, it was around 1,700. And so most of them are from Honduras, but a few are from El Salvador. Most are families with children, I would say. I think almost 50% of the group is children. Looking at the facility, the children are just playing and hanging out and around the fence. And I talked to several children when I was there on Saturday.
You interviewed some of the migrants in the facility through the fence. Let's listen to a little bit of your interview with Josue.
With all that we have suffered and then being stuck here, we will come out on top. There are children here. Look, children who are also coming from where we are. And look, for them, they should let us leave the factory, right? If we as adults are frustrated, imagine what the kids are feeling. We're sick. We're frustrated.
Alice, what have you been hearing about the conditions within the facility? As we mentioned at the top of the segment, journalists are not allowed inside the facility.
Yeah, so journalists haven't been allowed inside, but you come up to the facility, it's an old factory. It's surrounded by the Army, Mexican Army, and National Police. It's heavily guarded, but they let journalists freely ask questions through the fence. So I didn't have any problems interviewing people. And I interviewed a mother, a 28-year-old mother named Ingrid, and she had her 3-year-old son with her, Aaron. And she said, "It's ugly. I've never been locked up. It's like being a prisoner. They've treated us well, but we should be free. We haven't done anything." What I did hear is that, you know, they have food and they've been treated well, but they don't understand why they're essentially prisoners, especially with so many children for an undefined period of time.
What about medical personnel? We know journalists haven't been allowed in, but are medical personnel on site?
There are some medical personnel, but I did see that they, for example, did not let Doctors Without Borders in. And people there were complaining of being sick. They said there wasn't enough medical attention. They had colds, things like that. But they did say that there was some medical attention there, just maybe not enough.
On The Takeaway, we did a story a couple weeks ago about the U.S.'s Remain in Mexico asylum policy. This is also known officially as migrant protection protocols. Is this connected to that? This was the idea that President Trump said, basically, folks that are coming here to ask for asylum have to be held in Mexico. Is this the same thing?
That's a good question. I don't think it's the same thing because it hasn't been announced as that. I mean, if you're going to take a group of migrants and tell them that for their own security, you are basically locking them in an old factory, it seems like there should be some due process before you essentially treat a group of people as prisoners. I'm wondering if the Trump administration is testing out some kind of policy, because in practice, you are allowed to request asylum. And the biggest complaint of people I interviewed was that they have not been allowed to request asylum.
But now this is a decision that the Mexican government is making, not the U.S. government, which is why it's sort of interesting. Is there some sort of, is there an agreement that we know of outside of this Remain in Mexico asylum policy that could be doing this? Or what's the incentive for the Mexican government to basically hold these people in custody?
Well, I spoke to the public security chief of Coahuila on Saturday, Jose Luis Pliego, and I asked him about U.S. involvement in this. And he said that they are working closely with U.S. agencies. He didn't define what that means, but it definitely seems to be a binational effort. And actually, yesterday, a representative from the House of Representatives in Texas was at the facility, Ramon Romero, and he said that the U.S. government should support the state of Coahuila financially to help deal with the costs of keeping the caravan enclosed at the factory.
We should also be clear that asking for asylum is a legal thing. Eagle Pass, the city that shares this border with Piedras Negras in Mexico, is really where these folks were attempting to go. You went to Eagle Pass. What did you see there?
I was in Eagle Pass. I actually met with the sheriff of Eagle Pass. And I think what is interesting is that most people on the border have a very practical view of migration. And because so many of the people who, for example, are building houses and doing agricultural work are migrants, often both documented and undocumented. And so a lot of people wish there were more practical policies that reflected the need that we have for workers. And so that's something that the sheriff had talked about when I was with him.
It feels like these are groups of folks who want to migrate to the United States, plead asylum. They're being held in Mexico. What type of burden does that put on the Mexican law enforcement, or if any?
So the mayor of Piedras Negras, Claudio Bres, actually gave a press conference yesterday, and he said, does the caravan have a cost? Of course it has a cost. And so I don't know what the agreement is in terms of who's paying for all of this. In the press conferences, nobody has clarified that point.
One of the other things we're also talking about is how this plays into the President Trump, his latest declaration of a national emergency so that he can get the wall built on this side of the border. You've been at the border. What have you seen, Alice? Is there a national emergency happening there?
So I've been actually traveling the border for the last 8 days. And so I was in Juarez when President Trump declared the national emergency. And so I think that there is an emergency. It's not how he has framed it. The emergency currently is that because migrants are being limited or prevented from requesting asylum, or, for example, in Piedras Negras, they're being closed up in a factory as if they were prisoners, there's a huge level of frustration and desperation, and also just a buildup of migrants. Yesterday, I was in the International Bridge in Nuevo Laredo, and there are Venezuelans and Cubans and families from the Congo sleeping on that bridge because they have not been allowed to request asylum. And so I talked to them. I said, do you know you're waiting to request asylum? Has any official told you what the process is or when you'll be able to request? And they said, no, we're just sleeping in the order that we arrived so that hopefully at some point we can request asylum.
Alice, what's the future for the folks that are housed there? We said they're going to be bussed out. Is this something that we're going to continue to see under this new policy potentially?
That is a very good question. And when I talked to the chief of public security, all he would say is that that factory is going to be shut down and they won't use it again. But he didn't say if this is a practice or a policy that they're going to replicate with future groups of migrants.
Alice Driver is a freelance journalist based in Mexico. Alice, thanks so much for your reporting.
No, thank you for having me.
Alice has been reporting on the border town of Piedras Negras in Mexico, where migrants have been detained by local authorities in a factory. Back with you on The Takeaway, it's Tanzina Vega, it's President's Day, and the country's been talking a lot about the Commander-in-Chief and his powers over the last few days, especially following the President's declaration of a national emergency to fund a border wall. But today, we thought we'd try something completely different.
And Mr. Vice President, Dan, if I may.
We also have to work the dark side, if you will. We've got to spend time in the shadow.
Well, all those memes are basically true.
The American people deserve to have a vice president who commands their implicit trust.
Let's talk about the vice president.
I accept your nomination to run and serve as vice president of the United States of America.
And we're hearing from you on this as well at 877-8MY-TAKE and on Twitter. What's your favorite VP moment?
This is Pooja. I'm calling from Fremont, California. My favorite vice president moment was when Vice President Biden supported gay marriage. It forced the White House to take a position on gay marriage. The subsequent events from Biden's actions gave millions of deserving Americans a right they should always have been entitled to.
Scott Witke, Omaha, Nebraska. My favorite vice presidential moment is when Dan Quayle took on a fictitious character, Murphy Brown, and turned it into much more of a major issue than it needed to be.
A character who supposedly epitomizes today's intelligent, highly paid professional woman, mocking the importance of fathers.
Hi, this is Debbie, St. Pete, Florida. When I watched Al Gore tell the country he was not going to fight the results of the election in 2000, I immediately knew two things. One, he loved this country immensely. Two, we were in big trouble. It's one of the most courageous acts I've ever witnessed.
And I believe it is time to put this matter behind us once and for all and move forward with the business of the country.
This is Jennifer from East Hampton, New York. On this President's Day, my favorite moment in vice president history is when Obamacare passed and Joe Biden was overheard by microphone saying, "This is a big deal," while shaking President Obama's hand. They were both laughing, and it humanized them, and I'll never forget it.
Great stuff, everyone. Keep it coming. Meanwhile, the current Vice President, Mike Pence, was in Europe this past weekend, getting a fairly chilly reception at the Munich Security Conference.
I bring greetings from the 45th President of the United States of America, President Donald Trump.
Silence, not applause. Joel Goldstein is an expert on all things vice presidential. He's the author of The White House Vice Presidency, The Path to Significance, Mondale to Biden. Joel, thanks for joining us.
It's good to be with you.
So just a general recap for those of us, including myself, who may not know all of the details here. What is the job of the vice president generally? I mean, it's not just being an assistant to the president.
It's changed over time. It used to be primarily president of the Senate and being ready in case something happened to the president. But more recently, the vice president, beginning with Walter Mondale, has been a close advisor to the president and a troubleshooter, somebody who has access to the president and who advises the president on all matters, foreign, domestic, political, personnel and otherwise, and takes on high-level assignments that need to be handled at the highest level of the government.
And just to be clear, if something should happen to the president of the United States, the vice president would be the first in line to take over that position, correct?
That's right. In our history, on eight times when presidents have died and when Richard Nixon resigned, the vice president has succeeded to the presidency.
Let's take a moment to talk a little bit about our current vice president. 2 years into this presidency, what's your main takeaway of Vice President Pence?
Well, I think Vice President Pence has inherited the resources and the improvements in the vice presidency that began with Walter Mondale. He seems to have access to the president, and in some ways he's performing a conventional role. He's working with a very unique president. And that has an impact on his performance of his job. So that one of the things, for instance, is that Vice President Pence spends a lot of time really acting as the salesperson for President Trump, really, as he just did in Munich, giving speeches, celebrating President Trump's leadership. And I think he really has done that to a greater extent than any other vice president in memory.
One of the things he's also done is sort of be in this position of damage control for President Trump. Let's take a listen to an interview that Vice President Pence did with NBC's Hallie Jackson last month.
Which former presidents told President Trump, as he said, that he should have built a wall? All their representatives have denied that that was the case.
Well, I know the president has said that that was his impression from previous administrations, previous presidents. I know I've seen clips of previous presidents talking about the importance of border security, the importance of addressing the issue of illegal immigration.
That's different from telling the president, though, right?
But look, honestly, the American people want us to address this issue.
Does that sound typical of Mike Pence and how he's been approaching this role so far, Joel?
It really does. I mean, that's a good example, but you could play any number of similar examples where Vice President Pence has tried to sort of clean up after President Trump. When President Trump said there were good people on both sides in Charlottesville afterwards, Vice President Pence came out and said that President Trump had denounced racism. When President Trump suggested that military option was on the table in Venezuela some months ago, Vice President Pence said that the president had suggested that diplomatic or economic measures would be in order. When President Trump indicated that questions about the NATO alliance, Vice President Pence said that that we're committed to the NATO alliance. So again and again, one of his roles has been to sort of clean up after President Trump.
When we look at our most recent presidency before President Trump, when we look at the Obama administration, it felt like Vice President Biden was doing a little less cleanup and had a different role.
I think that's quite right. I think Vice President Pence has done this, I think, to a much greater extent because, President Trump tends to ad lib a lot. He tends to tweet a lot and he tends to be unconventional and pride himself on being sort of a norm buster and saying things that no other president of either party would say. And so it often falls to Vice President Pence to sort of try and bring the message back to something that's more politically acceptable.
Well, we think about the administration prior to the Obama administration. We think about the George H.W. Bush administration. Vice President Dick Cheney there had a very expanded role. And again, it was a different relationship, I think, than the one that we're seeing playing out today with Trump and Pence. What we saw with Obama and Biden. Cheney's role seemed to be very expansive and also one of maybe the elder statesmen here.
Well, I think that's quite right. I mean, Vice President Cheney was the only vice president that we've had in modern times who really started off by saying that he didn't want to run for president. So Vice President Cheney was very much of a inside the White House or inside government operator. And he was very engaged in moving the levers of power inside the administration, advising the president, implementing policies, shaping policy. He didn't perform as much the political role. He didn't perform as much the diplomatic role. Vice President Pence works with a president who's not as engaged in policy, whereas other vice presidents have wanted to be in the room. Sometimes for Vice President Pence, it may be reason not to want to be in the room.
What would that be, though, Joel? When you say it would be a reason for him not to want to be in the room, for what? Why?
Well, because of the investigations that are taking place with respect to possible relations between the campaign and Russia and so forth. There may be conversations that take place in the White House that the vice president doesn't want to be part of. Moreover, President Trump spends a great deal of time setting policy sort of by early morning tweets, and it's very hard for a vice president in that context to be in the room when that happens. So Vice President Pence has played more of a political role. He spent some time with Congress. He's done some travel, political travel domestically, which serves his political goals. But he's also taken on quite a lot of foreign travel. What's interesting about his foreign travel is that, I mean, Prince, on this recent trip to Germany, he seems to be speaking more to a domestic American political audience and to the president rather than to the people in the room.
Joel K. Goldstein is a professor at St. Louis University School of Law. Joel, thanks so much for joining us.
It's good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
This is Julie Mott from Fairfax, California. My favorite moment in vice presidential history is Teddy Roosevelt barreling out of the Adirondacks in a succession of wagons when McKinley takes a turn for the worse after being shot.
My name is Jennifer, and I'm calling from Glen Rose, Texas. I think my favorite vice presidential moment was Dan Quayle's misspelling incident. I'm not sure if it's fabulous or terrifying that we live in a country where someone's so ridiculous to become vice president.
This is Karen in Phoenix. My favorite VP moment was Joe Biden calling out Paul Ryan during the 2012 vice presidential debate, saying, "With all due respect, that's a bunch of malarkey." This is followed closely by his other debate zinger, "You're no Jack Kennedy."
This is Nikki Mohammed Fauzi from Arlington, Texas. My favorite vice presidential moment in history was when Dan Quayle misspelled potato at the spelling bee.
Scott Litke, Omaha, Nebraska. My favorite vice presidential moment is when Dan Quayle took on a fictitious character, Murphy Brown, and turned it into much more of a major issue than it needed to be.
A few months back, Vogue magazine asked me to join a group of women for a simple project: write letters to our younger selves. What would we want those greener versions of ourselves to know? So, as a 40-something now, I wrote a letter to my 20-something self about enjoying that moment, recognizing the extraordinary time I was living in then, and drinking a little less wine. And since that letter, I've been thinking a lot about what being post-40 today means for my own life. Hollywood would still like to have us believe that women over 40 are past their prime, but I have two women here with me who are themselves very strong evidence to the contrary. Both have contributed essays to a new collection by 15 different authors called On Being 40-ish. Jill Cardman is an author and creator of the Bravo TV series Odd Mom Out, which aired for 3 seasons starting in 2015, and she's in her mid-40s. Jill, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
And Sophronia Scott is a writer in her mid-50s. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
All right. So we can have a real honest conversation here. Ladies, it's about time. I say that this decade is sort of one where you sort of, I don't know, you kind of come into a different sense of yourself. Jill, tell me about
it. I agree. And when I read the essay collection, we all come from such different backgrounds and geographies. And the one thread that really linked everybody is that you just don't sweat the small stuff at this point. We've learned that it's just a waste of time and you're moving forward and not stressing as much. I feel way calmer now than I did in my 20s.
Well, and there's also a sense of, I mean, you started a new career.
That's right. I was like, now I'm 39 and I'm going to be an actress with cellulite and stretch marks after 3 kids.
Which is like, whoa.
I never could have done it in my early 20s. I think that kind of scrutiny during your formative years would have probably cracked me, whereas now I just don't care.
Mm-hmm. So, Fernia, now I read your chapter in the book and I thought I really understood the line when you said, I don't have time for this.
Yes.
Tell me how time changes when you hit 40 and move on.
Well, it's like Jill was saying, you don't sweat the small stuff, but you also know that you focus on what's important. and you don't have time for energy that isn't yours, for worries that aren't yours, and you're more aware, for me anyway, more aware of my gifts. And I need to focus on my family. I need to focus on my gifts.
And it's interesting because you talk a little bit about how you what it took for you to pursue your writing as an older writer.
Yeah, you know, I was a journalist. You know, I worked for Time and People magazines, but it took me a long time to learn what I wanted to write for myself. And
that's shocking. I mean, right there, that's for yourself.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. To develop my own voice, and even then, I wasn't focused on it truly until my sister died. One of my sisters died, and she was not even a year younger than myself, and she died at the age of 43.
Wow.
And I said, this has to stop. I have no idea what time I have left here, so I need to get to work.
Jill, I want to, that's a powerful thing. I think a lot of us, you know, who are, I always say you're fortunate if you've reached your 40s, right? Because mm-hmm. so many people don't have the opportunity to do that. Jill, you know, I had to write this letter to my 20-something-year-old self in Vogue, 44 versus 24. You talk about this idea in your essay of a funnel. Tell us about that.
I feel like when you're younger, there are all these opportunities. And when you're a little kid, of course, they can say they want to be anything and you feel like they maybe could. And then as you get older, you go down the funnel. So maybe, you know, you hit a certain age and you can't go to medical school as easily or whatever. So like the gates start to close and people start to say, okay, is this all there is? What else? I can't just like radically shake the Etch-a-Sketch. And I feel like you actually can, and things have changed, and, you know, whatever they say, like 40 is the new 30, and I don't know, 80 is the new 60, and 100 is the new dead. So
is that like, right?
Everything has shifted. The yardstick has shifted. So I feel like you're not as trapped in the funnel as you may have thought. And, you know, I would so much rather be 44 than 24. The mystery, all the question marks about what the future holds now when you're sort of more wasted deep in it. I appreciate the security of the funnel a bit instead of just like, what is this leading to? You know, we all have to pay our dues, but you never know how that will get you out.
And they don't end now. Like, I think a lot of what I hear when I talk to younger workers, I mean, just the fact that we're having this conversation on national radio, ladies, is a big deal because saying these ages are not exactly, you know, this was never seen as a positive. Do you think it's a positive, Sophronia?
That we're at this age.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And that we're seen as something more positive, that we're not seen as this, like, you know.
Right. We have a tremendous amount of wisdom to share. And I, you know, we were just talking, Jill and I, about reading Michelle Obama's book.
So good.
And just so excited about the wisdom present and to show up in the world in a certain way and to know that people can, that we can share that and people can absorb that and know that everything's going to be okay on a certain level.
How do you think the being 40 or 40-ish or in your 40s has shifted, particularly for women, over the past couple decades?
I think there's more empowerment, right? That there's not a sense that it's over, right? And we're invisible. I think we're owning our bodies. We're becoming more appreciative of the way we look and that we're taking ownership of our gifts and moving toward fulfilling them.
Jill, what do you think? I mean, what's the biggest shift you've seen?
I think the generation gap has closed a lot because 44 felt really old when I was younger. Mm. And now I don't think my 16-year-old sees me as old. I think, yeah, like, you know, you're listening to more of the same music. You're having different conversations. People are younger now than they used to be. It just I don't know. I remember feeling like my grandparents were so old. And my kids don't think my parents are that old.
Right. You wouldn't picture your mom a few years ago in a spin class.
That's right.
Right. Right. But then also, I mean, I'm wondering, let's be honest. I mean, there are some difficult things about this decade as well. I know that.
But it's less difficult when people are sharing it. So like, my mom said no one talked about menopause when she was going through it. Now a lot of people are talking about it. There's just less, you know, mystery and people behind the curtains trying to shroud their beauty and beauty secrets and all that stuff is now way more open.
Mm-hmm. Right. But I think you're talking about the loss. Right.
Well, I'm also talking about the other stuff, right? Yeah. There's a conversation, I think, that also happens where there's this great conversation happening about us being in our 40s and saying, okay, these are all the new ways. We're at spin class. We're looking great. We don't care as much. You know, there's a certain freedom, but there's also a heaviness that can come, you know, with this decade, I think.
Yeah, the heaviness, for me anyway, comes from the loss of friends, right? So a very dear friend of mine died last year. The man who took my author photos died in December. Just that loss is heartbreaking. And I'm thinking about how do I take on this loss but not lose a sense of joy? How do I mourn without, because I know this is going to keep happening, right?
Well, one thing they say too is that as people get older, they get happier.
They get happier.
I think so. I mean, they say we reach this, you know, sort of lull around this age in our 40s, and then we sort of get happier as we go on.
I can see that because I'm reaching for, it's like a feeling of childhood again, right? To appreciate the feeling of laughter. And I feel like that's going to keep coming as I get older more and more.
Jill, what do you think?
Someone had told me that the Buddha said the happiest people think of death three times a day. And I guess the older you think of it and you're losing friends or caregiving for your ailing parents or whatever it is, you're very aware of your mortality. And so you're going to kind of seize the day more.
Yes. Suddenly things don't become, they don't have that. Well, they do take on a certain weight. And hopefully the idea is that we give that weight where it's needed. Yes. So I'll ask both of you the same question I was asked when Vogue asked me. Writing to yourself 20 years prior, if you had something to say, there's one piece of advice that you would give your 20-something-year-old self, do you know what that would be? With the hindsight you have now in your 40s.
I would say put on that crocodile skin. It just don't be so insensitive. Don't take things as personally. I always hated that phrase, but it's kind of true. Like now I have such thick skin and things don't bother me as much. I mean, people on Twitter, when I first got on TV, were saying like, she looks like Marilyn Manson threw up on her or whatever. And I just, you know, it stings for a second, but I really don't care now. Like I really truly don't. And I think it just would have been so, it would have destroyed me at a young age.
Yeah. I would tell myself to take more risks because, you know, and I said, I worked at Timing for 15 years and I was at that place where everyone is supposed to work to get there. And I didn't know how to give it up when I realized I wanted to do something else. So I would have jumped sooner, I think.
I need to brag for Sophronia. She was part of the team that did the original Generation X cover of Time Magazine story. At 24.
20-something, yes.
As I mentioned in the introduction, no one cares about Generation X, so I'm thrilled that we're having this conversation. I say that, you know, wryly, of course, but I do mean part of it.
Love Gen X.
I think we were an important thing here. You know, as far as, I'm wondering, when I look at women, younger women today who are trying to navigate, and they look at where we're sitting, and they say, you know, all the success and all the things, and it feels like, I don't know if it's easier for younger women today. And what I mean by that is I feel like the list has just gotten bigger. Like the list of things that women, young women feel they have to accomplish by a certain age has gotten even longer. So now it's, you know, children, the big job, the big education, the big degree, the house, all of this pressure. And I'm wondering, is that different from when we were in our 20s?
Yes, there's that pernicious side of social media that gives you this keyhole into people's seemingly perfect lives, but it's all artifice and filters and, you know, a snapshot of things that's highly curated. And we didn't have that keyhole into other people's lives as much.
Yeah, and I also think there's the focus on youth. Right, that you're truly considered successful if, you know, like 35, under 35, right? Mm-hmm. We have so many of those lists. So if you were going to have meaningful success, that you need to have it in your 20s and 30s. I think that is really hard.
Yeah, and I think that one of the things that I try to advise younger women on is, like, you don't have to get you may not get it all by the time you're 30, right? I know that personally, and that's okay. But that's a hard thing for a lot of people to swallow. It's a very goal-oriented society we live in. Social media, Jill, as you mentioned, has sort of added to the pressure, and I feel like there's all of this, you know, I have to do this all before I'm 30.
Yeah.
And I often want to, you know, don't want to burst any bubbles, but you might not. And that's okay.
Yeah, it's a marathon and not a sprint. And I have a sprinter's personality, so that was a hard thing for me to swallow. But it shakes out later. You know, it's all an investment. You might not realize what the seeds you're planting are going to yield, but they might grow later.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I sometimes would think, well, should I have tried to have children earlier? You know, I have one son, and I didn't have a child until I was 38. But looking back on it now, I really don't think I would be the mom that I was then. I have such an empowered, calm sense of my motherhood that I don't think I would have had in my 20s.
Mm-hmm. I hear that a lot from people too. And I think, you know, you sort of going through these things in your 30s and heading into your 40s is what also I think brings us this sense of calm or this sense of strength.
Yeah.
Totally.
All right. Jill Kargman is the author and creator of the Bravo TV series Odd Mom Out, and Sophronia Scott is a writer. Thanks to you both for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Liz Ritter. I'm calling from New York City. As a woman in my 50s, I feel, I don't know, a little more invisible than I did when I was in my 20s, but frankly, it's kind of liberating. I really don't give a, well, yeah, I can't say that on the air, but I don't care what people think, and it gives me the opportunity to focus on what's important rather than being concerned about what other people think.
Angela from Duncan, South Carolina. At 50 years old, I find myself divorcing for the second time. This time it was 22 years. I tried exceptionally hard to make it work. We both did. If I would have been honest with myself 23 years ago, it would have saved us a lot of trouble. I wanted him to be my partner because I didn't have a partner, not because he was the right partner.
This is Kelly from Tampa, Florida. I wish I knew then that our stomach does not lie, our hearts sentimentalize, and our brains rationalize, but our stomach is really our most honest friend. There are times that it raised red flags that I suppressed, and I sure wish that I had not. We owe nobody politeness when our security feels threatened, and it is okay to not make everything look effortless. The days are very long, but the years are feel like they're becoming shorter. And I really appreciate being exempted from always having to be on, which was a pressure I definitely felt as a young woman. I'm learning that I like myself a little more, and getting rattled over foolishness is just that, and I wish I knew it a long time ago.
Hi, this is Anna from Seattle. I would say to my 20-year-old self, not to lose my optimism and confidence, not to let other people's concepts of who I should be dictate my actions, and to leave my first marriage at least 5 years earlier. Your life is yours to live, and if something does not bring you joy, let it go.
We'd love for you to join the conversation, so give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE and tell us about how your perspective on life changed after 40. That's it for us today. Great to be back with you all. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
NYC Now delivers breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. By sponsoring our programming, you'll reach a community of passionate listeners in an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to learn more.